Nearly 4,700 refugees have resettled in the United States since President Donald Trump signed an executive order aimed at banning refugees from seven Muslim-majority countries. Refugee Processing Center data show more than 2,000 came from those seven nations. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras, a public radio show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. Federal judges struck down parts of the president's order, and since then, the U.S. refugee resettlement program has been quietly doing its work. Administration sources say revisions to the order are underway. Meanwhile, refugees fleeing their home countries face a lot of uncertainty, and for those who've already arrived here, anxiety runs high. Taryn Mento of KPBS explains how many refugee families in San Diego are struggling to make ends meet.
Do you want to show me your bed?
6-year-old Rahaf walks into a room with two sets of bunk beds and touches the top bed. She shares the four twin mattresses with four of her siblings. Next door, another sibling shares a larger bed with her parents. Father Jalal Falah says the two-bedroom apartment is a step up from where the family of eight was living just a few weeks ago. Back then, they shared two rooms at an El Cajon motel. He says the situation wasn't ideal for his kids.
With the kids, if one was by himself, one would be indifferent, but with children, it was very bad. Very bad in the hotel. It wasn't suitable for children.
Falah was among nearly 800 Syrian refugees who arrived in the county last year. They trickled in at first, but at the end of the year, more than 400 arrived within a two-month period. This left resettlement agencies like the International Rescue Committee scrambling to find affordable housing for hundreds of people on limited funds. The committee's Erica Boree says the agency has good relationships with landlords in the county to help with this, and many refugees move in with relatives already living here. But the economy makes it more difficult to find new housing.
We really do work with a wide variety of properties in, you know, in across multiple neighborhoods in San Diego. But it is definitely true that, you know, as the economy in San Diego has come out of the recession, unemployment rates are down, vacancy rates are down, all of those kinds of things certainly contribute to a more competitive rental market.
Because of this, some refugees stayed in temporary housing longer than usual. The Falah family, who came from Syria, say they were in the motel for almost 2 months. Like most refugees, they arrived with no credit and no salary and are allotted a one-time stipend of $925 per person from the resettlement agency. But Boree says this must cover all of their startup expenses, from clothing and furniture to rent and security deposit. Plus, the agency looks for homes near schools and public transit because few can afford a car.
Obviously, you want to get that family out of the motel as quickly as possible, but you also want to make sure that they're going to be in a home that's going to work for their family as they settle in.
While they waited for an affordable place, the Falah family's one-time allotment was covering their nightly motel rooms. Now, a few weeks into the family's new place, Falah is worried the leftover funds and welfare assistance won't cover his family's needs. In comes Bayan Mitar, who on this day is handing out toiletries to refugees.
Shampoo.
An interior designer turned accidental nonprofit founder. Mitar launched the Syrian Community Network in San Diego after a friend introduced her to a newly arrived family.
I could tell they had nothing, and when I'd open my trunk to show them what they needed, if they needed anything out of what I brought of necessities, they only took a few items and gave me numbers and addresses of other families that needed more help in their opinion.
Since then, she's helped support 170 Syrian families with basic needs, but she says the biggest need is rental assistance.
So I know the resettlement agencies are doing their best to try to get them out, but some of these families are really large, and the rent prices in San Diego for apartments is extremely high. So with the amount of money they have and are able to afford, it's really difficult to find apartments and at the price that it's needed to sustain their living here.
Mitar's organization now helps cover the rent for 115 families. More are asking each day, including the Falah family. Falah says even his 6-year-old daughter knows there's something to worry about.
So I have a daughter 6 years old. She says, Dad, what happens if you can't pay for the house? Will they take us out? Would we have to sleep outside like the people who sleep outside in the garden? I swear to God, that is what the little one asks me.
Recalling the interaction brought tears to his eyes. He said he hopes to find a job soon, but he hasn't learned English, and because of an old injury, he might need surgery. Another hurdle to overcome.
That was Taryn Mento with KPBS in San Diego. Sara Beltran Hernandez is the El Salvadoran woman who was removed from a Texas hospital bed. Her lawyers had filed a new lawsuit this week in federal court, hoping to get her case reviewed before a U.S. district court judge instead of an immigration judge. Beltran Hernandez suffers from a brain tumor located behind her eyes and needs surgery. Immigration agents allegedly made her leave a Fort Worth hospital and sent her back to the Prairie Land Detention Center in Alvarado because she is undocumented. Dallas attorney Chris Hamilton initially handled her case.
She wanted access to a lawyer. She wanted medical care. She was in severe pain. She has a brain tumor, and she was not getting access to medical care and was very concerned. She was a refugee from El Salvador who was fleeing violence in that country and possibly also some domestic threats. And so she came to the United States, at some point sought asylum. So it is a just terrifying case all around and just a heartbreaking story.
Officials say Beltran Hernandez entered the country illegally in 2015 and her orders for deportation came last month. She had been in detention for more than a year. And the latest news is that Beltran Hernandez was released from the detention center Thursday after a Dallas immigration judge approved her $15,000 bond. The 26-year-old will now be able to seek medical care. Turning now to New Mexico, where the Public Education Department has been unwavering in its focus on using standardized tests to, quote, raise the bar for education. But New Mexico state senators recently approved a resolution that proposes a new paradigm of student assessment. Hannah Colton of KUNM has more.
If you want to hear about the stakes in high-stakes testing, just ask a working parent who's struggling to make ends meet.
If you don't do it, it can really mess up your chances for college and for getting scholarships.
2 years ago, Kelly's daughter was among the hundreds of New Mexico students that refused to take the Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers, or PARC, test. Albuquerque Public Schools warns that opting out may prevent students from graduating with a diploma down the road. Kelly says it's a catch-22 for parents who want to protect their kids' future but are frustrated with standardized testing.
Yeah, and I really wish that we'd actually connect stuff more to real-life ideals rather than a piece of paper or a computer screen now sometimes.
We tried multiple times to talk to New Mexico Education Secretary Hannah Scandera to get her take on this. She did not respond. But she spoke with New Mexico PBS in the spring of 2015 during the first round of PARC testing.
Sometimes it's ironic to me. We spend so much time talking about an assessment. And you and I, when we were in school, we took an annual assessment. It's state and federal law.
Scandera praised the computer-based test for being more rigorous and taking less time.
So it's not a new idea to measure how well we're doing. That's an important conversation to have, but the real important conversation is, what are we going to do about it? How do we provide reading coaches, interventions to support them when they struggle? But the key is, you don't know a student is struggling till you know where they are.
The number of states using PARC to meet National Common Core standards has shrunk from 24 in 2012 to less than 10 this year. Still, Scandera, who's now chair of PARC's unpaid governing board, says PARC is the best assessment in the nation today. This year, she touted New Mexico's record-high graduation rates as proof that reforms are working. But the value of testing based on Common Core in the U.S. is far from clear. In 2015, the nation's report card showed a drop in math scores for the first time in decades. Tony Monfiletto in Albuquerque says it's time for a change, but not because the bar is set too high. He's executive director of the NM Center for School Leadership.
Standardized tests were seen as being a way to provide equity because it has theoretically high expectations for every student. So that notion, I think, is powerful and appropriate.
The next step, he says, is finding new ways to set high standards. In 2015, Congress passed a new federal education law that gives states more control over how they test students.
They really recognized that heavy-handed federal presence was really undermining innovation and local control.
Now, Monfaletto is backing a Democrat-sponsored bill to allow New Mexico to seek federal funds to create an alternative assessment system.
My ideal scenario would be that we would have what are called performance tasks, which are students actually doing things, completing tasks, and the outcome of those tasks would be judged by teachers. So you wouldn't have a standardized test.
It would be a radical shift for New Mexico, but Monfaletto says it's not a new idea. Montessori schools have done it for decades, and APS high schools like Next Gen Academy use project-based learning. Monfaletto says it's about identifying what young people need to be able to do to succeed and finding practical ways to judge whether they can do those things.
I want everyone to write one skill that they think they will need from school in order to get there.
Students from the public charter Native American Community Academy weighed in last month on how they'd like to be taught and assessed. Junior Rashawn Edison says science was a subject he used to hate until he had a teacher who took it beyond the textbook.
What worked for me was just like a lot of humor and like different activities that coincide with the subject we're teaching to make it more engaging, because like I'm a person that just like wants to like do something, like not just sit there.
Edison and his peers had kind of a hard time imagining an assessment outside the realm of testing, perhaps because they've always had tests. But they all know what it feels like to be excited about learning. And they know it looks a little different for everyone. I'm Hannah Colton.
Coming up on Fronteras, winning on and off the court. A basketball coach scores points with her diverse team of students outside the rim.
My biggest challenge is making sure these kids are fed and making sure they have warm clothes when it's cold.
We'll explore that story and take a ride with Los Vaqueros Rio Grande.
I approached this talk show and I said, well, you know how come there are no Hispanics rides coming in? Well, nobody has approached us. So I approached them and they granted me a permit, you know.
That's coming up after this break. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio, and this is Fronteras. South of Dallas, the Duncanville Pantherettes are a girls' basketball powerhouse. They're in San Antonio this weekend in search of their 10th state basketball title. KERA's Bill Zeeble visits a school that's undergone massive demographic change. Yet through it all, these girls keep winning.
Coach Kathy Self-Morgan is leading her Pantherettes to another lopsided win. At this point, they're 37-2. In Duncanville, that's almost a down year. Last season, they were undefeated. Self-Morgan arrived here 17 years ago, already a champion, with three state titles at Westlake High, near Austin.
I wasn't expecting to leave Westlake. I thought my ashes would be buried there. I'd been there 22 years.
Self-Morgan's Austin suburb was mostly white, and so was she. When the coach moved to Duncanville, the team was racially mixed. She points up to her office wall, pictures of every team she's coached. They start pretty mixed, white and black, then all black. Now, with a booming Hispanic student population, there's a Latina starter. The fundamental change, though, isn't race.
My biggest challenge is making sure these kids are fed and making sure they have warm clothes when it's cold. Making sure that their needs are being met, physical and emotional.
That's a big job at a school where two-thirds of the kids are labeled economically disadvantaged. Duncanville Superintendent Mark Smith, an African-American, took the job in April. He says this suburban district looks more like a big city school system. While residents still take great pride in the schools, families are moving out.
They want more programs, they want more options, and we hadn't been providing that. And if you can go 5-10 minutes away and get an all-day pre-K, that's pretty appealing to parents. If you can go 10-15 minutes away and have your kid in a collegiate academy where they are graduating with an associate's degree, that's pretty impressive.
Coach Self-Morgan does what she can so the team stays impressive. Every one of her players over the last 6 years has gone to college on a basketball scholarship. That's 100%. She's got the secret, which isn't so secret.
You know, the coach has got to have a culture that the kids buy into. And these kids, if they love you, you love them, they'll do anything for you, and I do anything for them, and they know it.
So when she demands hard work, on and off the court, and she does, senior Pantherette Nina Alvarez delivers.
We know every game isn't given to us. We have to work for it every, 32 minutes?
Yeah.
Junior Anaya Thomas jumps in.
If you don't, you get subbed out.
Every minute, every second you're on the court, go get it. There's no stop. There's no rest. Like, if you want it, go get it. And she makes it fun.
The most fun comes from winning, which is by now a Duncanville tradition. So much so that the town's motto, City of Champions, is based on the Pantherettes' 9 state titles going back to 1976. Volleyball coach Marla Hust was the basketball team manager in 1990, her senior year. That's when legendary coach Sandra Meadows led the Pantherettes to one of her 4 state championships.
You know, we really are the city of champions, and these kids don't truly understand. You know, there's 2 young ladies. I know Nina. I've known her since she was in the 7th grade. They were raised to win. They were raised not just to win in the sense of the scoreboard, but in that standard of excellence that Duncanville believes in.
Bobby Goldman believes, at 81, the Panther graduate and lifetime resident has rarely skipped the girls' basketball game in 66 years.
I've had some physical problems that I had to miss some earlier in the year, had open heart surgery and bypass.
The lifelong bachelor and retired IRS agent, who's white, worried fans like him might disappear as the school's minority population surged. Pantherette pride prevailed.
It's just cooperation and working together and working for that common cause of having the great girls' basketball team. We just don't accept any dissent in there. If you're going to be a dissenter, you don't belong as part of the Pantherette organization or a follower.
Goldman's a pure fan, already looking ahead to see what kind of players will make up next year's team and the years after. First, he wants to see this team take another title. For Fronteras, I'm Bill Zeeble.
What happens on the Texas border with Mexico has a way of making the news these days, but there are those who travel the roads from the border who are making the trip symbolically for reasons of heritage and history. Houston Public Media's Travis Bubenik caught up with Los Vaqueros Rio Grande and found out why their trek on horseback means so much to them.
Here's a ride coming in now.
I'm talking with 81-year-old Larry Ramirez when some of his friends pull into an abandoned parking lot off Highway 59. They're wagons and horses, moving a little slower than the cars flying by behind us.
It's a good ride. It's a long ride, long, hard ride.
They're headed to the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo. Ramirez founded this trail rider team, one of 13 teams converging on Houston from all over Texas. His group started their journey at the border. A lifelong Houstonian, Ramirez drove big rigs for about 2 decades, but he wouldn't call that his life's work.
I've done everything a man can possibly do, son.
He founded Los Vaqueros Rio Grande 45 years ago for one simple reason.
Because there were no Hispanics rides when I started. I approached a stock show and I said, well, you know, how come there are no Hispanics rides coming in? I said, well, nobody has approached us. So I approached them and they granted me a permit, you know.
As to why, he figured the ride should start from the border and travel the farthest distance of all the rodeo trail rides.
It was just a wild idea. I just thought maybe why not start from Mexico, you know?
He wanted this ride to honor his Hispanic heritage. He doesn't know much about his grandparents or family further back. He says he was just too busy working most of his life to investigate the family tree. So this is, in a way, his chance to explore that history. One of Ramirez's riding buddies is Gary Foster. He braves the Texas highways on 19th century wagons out of a fascination with old customs and old technology. He shows me around his ride.
This wagon is a Melbourne Model 88, and he was building them in Toledo, Ohio, up until the end of the 1890s. And the best I can tell by the serial numbers on this was built somewhere around the middle of 1890.
Explaining the art of horse harness, he says he keeps this wagon as authentic as possible to the time it comes from. No rubber tires, all original undercarriage, and he drives mules, not horses, like the old timers used to. Foster's taken the wagon on longer rides through Texas ranches, and he says there is more to it than just the gear.
When you spend 6 months traveling around like that, it's a camaraderie that is unusual in this day and time when a lot of people in the cities don't even know their next door neighbor's name.
Trail riders are a family, he says, and family is what's keeping Los Vaqueros alive. In his old age, Larry Ramirez is handing this ride off to his son David. Some parts of the ride have changed. Decades ago, the team started the trail from Mexico, but with tighter border controls through the years, it got too complicated and expensive to bring horses across the river. Still, the younger Ramirez says the team will be around for decades to come.
Oh, it'll last. I mean, somebody's always going to be trail riding because there's always families. I raised my kids up in this, and they're gonna continue to trail ride because they're in it. It's in their blood.
I'm pretty proud of what I've done. My sons are taking over the ride. It seems like they're going to keep it alive after I'm gone. Of course, I won't know that.
In Kendleton, Texas, I'm Travis Bubenik.
And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Alexis Yancey produced this broadcast. Shelley Koffler is our executive producer. Sharanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.